Good morning, and welcome to Coastal Conversations here on WERU. We explore issues facing Maine's coastal communities through dialogue with people who live, work, and play on our coast. From fisheries to tourism, from energy to environment, from economy to ecology, we go beyond the social media soundbites, probing deeply into complex issues and solutions. Coastal Conversations is supported by Maine Sea Grant in partnership with Scudic Institute and the First Coast. Welcome to this month's episode of Coastal Conversations.
Hi everyone, it's Catherine Devine of Scudic Institute. I'm your host for this episode of Coastal Conversations. In this episode, we'll be exploring two of the ways in which Acadia National Park may change in the future. First, we'll talk to Jay Wason about how extreme climate events might change the composition of Maine's forests. Then, we'll talk to Caroline Kanaski about her research on the southern pine beetle and how its northern progression threatens Acadia's pitch pine trees. Let's jump in.
Thank you so much for joining me today. To begin, can you introduce yourself and tell me a little bit more about your connection to the Northeast and Maine?
Sure, yeah. So my name is Jay Wason. I'm an assistant professor here in the School of Forest Resources at the University of Maine in Orono. And I'm born and raised in the Northeastern United States, originally from upstate New York, and I've been doing research in the forests of the Northeastern United States for a little over 10 years now. Generally trying to understand how environmental stressors like climate change and droughts and heat waves and those types of things impact our forests and what we can do to make sure that our forests are resilient and can handle some of those stressors in the future.
And that relates to the bulk of our conversation today, which is your research project, Extreme Climate Impacts on Trees. So a little background, please correct me if I'm wrong, but historically Maine's forests have had an abundance of natural regeneration, which for those of you who don't know, is the process by which older trees provide seeds that fall, germinate, and ultimately restock the site. But with rising rates of extreme climate events brought on by climate change, such as heat waves, droughts, midwinter thaws, we don't really know what our future forests will look like or how long natural tree generation will be enough to sustain them. So that's where your research project comes in, Extreme Climate Impacts on Trees. Can you just elaborate a little bit on that? Correct me if I'm wrong. Tell me more about your research project and how you came up with the idea.
Yeah, you're definitely on the right track there. And so one of the things that's most kind of unique about trees in some ways is how long it takes them to get to be big trees. And so when we think about forests, many people focus on the large canopy trees around them and think about how old they are and how strong they are and maybe how resilient they are to all of the environmental changes that they experience. But what we know is one of the most sensitive life stages for trees are these really young, early life stages when the trees are small seedlings and saplings. And at those times, they're very vulnerable, or they can be very vulnerable to environmental stressors like heat waves and drought and other stressors like that. And so what our concern is and what our research is trying to better understand is how our native species that currently exist in a lot of our forests, how resistant and resilient those tree seedlings are to some of the stressors that we're seeing that are increasing in the Northeastern United States. And at the same time, also trying to see how some tree species that are not as common in the Northeastern United States, or at least in some of the forests right now, maybe moving in and become more common in the future as we see more of these extreme climate events and the climate in general just changing in the region. And this becomes important in a state like Maine, where, as you mentioned, historically we've relied on a lot of natural regeneration, especially with regards to forest management. But what we might have to start thinking about more is this concept of assisted migration. And so this idea of actually bringing in new species that may be better adapted both to the current and future climate conditions that we expect for those sites. And so the question kind of becomes twofold. One, the climate has changed a little bit already, but it still gets quite cold here in the winter, for example. So if you try to bring up a species from Georgia, for example, up to Maine, it's pro- probably going to get killed by the cold temperatures pretty fast. So we can't go right ahead to a species from way far south. That's a little bit of an extreme example, but we need to know which species can already handle the current climate conditions we have now, but also maybe better adapted to kind of the new conditions that we're expecting in the future. And so our research project has brought together a group of 10 different tree species that we've been planting at six locations across the state. And those tree species represent both common native tree species like red spruce, white pine, balsam fir, a lot of those common gymnosperms that we have in the region, but also some more slightly southerly distributed species or species that are not as common in this part of the state. Species like American chestnut, red oak, which we do have around quite a bit, but it's one of those species that we expect to do better in the future. Eastern red cedar, for example, a species that we don't get very much in Maine or northern parts of Maine. So we've planted these at six locations in what we're calling kind of a coastal to inland gradient. And we've got some sites out at Skudik Peninsula, and we have sites that carry us all the way north up to Greenville, Maine, for folks familiar with that. So a little over an hour north of Bangor. And that represents actually a huge climate gradient. So it's a really large climate gradient as we move across that, that actually is representative of the climate gradient across the entire northeastern United States. So that moderating impact of the coast keeps temperatures from getting too cold and things from getting too extreme along the coast. And as you move further and further north inland, you get away from that and you start to get much more extreme colder temperatures. And so at each of those six locations, then we've planted these tree species, and we did that this past summer, this past spring of 2023. And we've gave them a year to acclimate, and then this coming summer, we're going to be implementing these experimental heat waves and droughts on those trees in order to better understand how they respond to those conditions and what that may mean about their ability to be introduced in some of these places for different management or restoration type initiatives.
So I know that these simulations aren't going to happen until the summer, but the trees, as you mentioned, they're already there, and so they're given this year to acclimate. How have they been doing? Has anything been surprising, or is it just about as expected?
Yeah, well, with scientific research, there's always surprises. And so we planted these trees in the spring of 2023. And for those folks that remember, in May of 2023, there was a period of about at least 2 weeks of really abnormally warm and dry weather. It turned out to be great for getting volunteers to come out to our sites and help us do our planting and everything. But unfortunately, when you're planting seedlings, they need a lot of moisture and they don't want it to be too hot and too sunny because it dries them out. And so we actually had drought conditions that hit our trees within the first couple of weeks of them being planted. And so one of the things that was a little bit surprising to us was that we ended up with 100% mortality almost of our red spruce trees. And so red spruce is a really common tree species, especially along coastal and interior Maine. It's an evergreen tree species. Kind of looks kind of like a Christmas tree for those of your listeners that are not too used to thinking about tree species. So it is kind of an evergreen tree species like a Christmas tree. And we had 100% mortality of that tree. And that was really frustrating for us because it's one of the trees we're most interested in because we suspect that it's one of the most sensitive to some of the climate changes we're experiencing. So it doesn't grow much further south than kind of this region in central Maine. If it does, it's in mountains, for example, where it's cooler. And so in some way, one way it was kind of disappointing and surprising that we had so much mortality from this tree species, but at the same time, it's not surprising because it's one of the species that we expect to suffer the most with some of these things like drought and warm conditions that were happening during that planting time. So it did give us a little bit of a preview of what we might expect. Now there's other things with kind of as you plant and stress that plants go through. It's a little bit different than may happen in the field. But we did go through and replace those red spruce trees, and we're going to replace a few more this spring. So it still will be in our experiment. We'll still implement those summer heat waves and droughts. And at the same time, though, we also had especially some hardwood tree species that we planted from further south and these trees like eastern red cedar. Those are more southerly distributed trees. Those tended to do much better through that kind of dry period in early May. And so it gave us a little bit of a preview of what we might expect moving forward with our study. So that's been kind of probably the biggest surprise that we've seen so far. Other than that, we have a really great graduate student working on this project as part of her master's thesis here in the School of Forest Resources. So she's been keeping a close eye on the trees, making sure that they have the water and stuff, everything that they need. And she's going to be working with another undergraduate student from the University of Maine this summer to help implement those drought treatments and heat wave treatments and keep track of those trees through it.
Yeah, kind of bad news about the red spruce. Considering it's such a popular tree in Maine, this kind of brings me to more of the implications of the project. So, a bit of a two-pronged question. One, why is it important that these to know about the resistance of certain species of trees to some of these extreme climate events? And two, how might your findings impact how Acadia or Maine or land managers, really anywhere, maybe in the more specifically in the northern forest, deal with like their forests?
Good. Those are both really good questions. I'll start with kind of the importance of the type of work and the way we set it up first. From a scientific perspective, what we can do with this information, we actually already are putting together some research proposals to do more than just kind of observe what happens here and extend this. And one of the directions that we want to extend this into is with modeling just tree distributions and tree migrations with climate change. One of the challenges with doing kind of modeling of where might these trees move in the future is we often are constrained by what the trees have experienced in the past. And so we look at where the trees are existing now, we look at their environmental conditions they're experiencing, and then we kind of project that maybe they may try to follow those conditions into the future. But sometimes it becomes a challenge to know, well, what would this tree do, or how could it actually handle maybe a period of drier or hotter or colder temperatures? And so, with our experimental work, what we do is we take trees and we put them in places that you normally wouldn't find them. So, that's why we have these trees that we've planted along this wide gradient. And that gives us new data kind of outside the range of what we may often find out in the forest that can help us see, well, even with these future climate changes that are beyond the scope of maybe what we've seen for this tree species in this region before, here's how we think it may respond. And that can help inform how we think about parameterizing or setting up the numbers and things that piece together those models to make those predictions. On the same side of things, some of these models actually try to simulate and calculate all of the fine scale details of how a plant works to better understand how a plant will respond to climate change. And so our detailed measurements about things like photosynthesis and water use of some of these plants that we're also going to be doing can help us better understand how, if we then basically turn the knobs and change the dials on these environmental conditions around them, we get better numbers to help us understand how these trees may respond. So that's really where I think the importance of this type of research comes into from a scientific perspective. To jump to the second part of your question, kind of about how the results from this work may impact or change management, it's especially important along the coast of Maine. That's been kind of for another research project we're doing, focus on the conservation of coastal forests, better understanding coastal forests and the environmental stressors they're going through. So I'll kind of use that as an example and Acadia National Park as an example, but also conservation organizations and land trusts around the park. So, a lot of resources go into conservation and identifying areas of high conservation value that you may want to conserve for a specific purpose. And what our research can help folks understand, and now I'm kind of allowing tangentially to connect to other parts of research that I do at different scales as well, is where they may best allocate those conservation dollars and why. And so, in some cases, and what some of our other research projects are looking into are, for example, where we see red spruce on the landscape, does some of our research help us understand that, well, red spruce in this place on the landscape is more likely to experience heat waves and droughts in the future? And our experiments tell us that red spruce is very sensitive to heat waves and droughts. So, therefore, at this place in the landscape, it might not make sense to expect a red spruce forest there in 50 or 100 years. And that information can help land managers think, well, if their goal was to conserve a red spruce forest, that may not be the best place to do it. Or if their goal is to maintain forest cover, they may want to start thinking about opportunities to encourage or promote other species to be successful in that forest instead of red spruce. And at the same time, our research is identifying places where just to continue with the red spruce example, where red spruce may persist for a long time because of the local environmental conditions or the hydrology or just the climate that we expect at that location, and maybe the coastal influence, for example, keeping it cool and moist. And in those places, that can be an opportunity to really manage for red spruce or apply conservation strategies that help to promote red spruce. So that's kind of from a conservation lens. It pretty easily scales out to more of an intensive management lens as well. If you think about managing a forest and trying to regenerate a forest after you come in and do some type of harvest, if you try to regenerate red spruce in a place that our research suggests red spruce won't be successful in the future, you might start thinking about trying to regenerate different species, and that brings in different management regimes that you might try to consider.
I'm curious, I know that you've worked with volunteers in the past. Are there any opportunities for a volunteer to get involved with the project?
Definitely, yeah. So we had a bunch of volunteers. We were really lucky. I forget the exact numbers. We had hundreds of volunteer hours where people came to help us planting our trees in the springtime. And like 30 to 40 volunteers that came out during that period of time. Yes, we are looking for volunteers in the future, a little bit less intensive because a lot of the work was around the initial planting and everything. Many of these sites are visible to the public. They're in places that we want the public to be able to see them and learn from them. And so I'd suggest potentially checking out, there's a site at the Skudik Institute campus. So you could reach out to me or you could reach out to somebody at the Skudik Institute to talk to one of them about where the site might be, and they can see it. They're fenced. And so we just ask that people don't go into the fence, but you're definitely welcome to view them from outside the fence. We also have a place with the Blue Hill Heritage Trust. They have a location for us in the Surrey Forest that we can point people to. And so if there's any folks, especially in that region that want to reach out to us and find opportunities to volunteer, or they can be involved in helping us keep an eye on the sites, they can reach out directly to me. Feel free to share my email address with everyone that may be listening to this. And we'd be happy to try to find opportunities for them to volunteer for sure.
Okay, great. I will link more information in the description. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Catherine. Yeah, I really appreciate your interest in our research, and I hope that the outcomes from this really help conservation and management of our forests in Maine for sure.
You're listening to Coastal Conversations on WERU at 89.9 FM and streaming online at weru.org.
Today I'm with Caroline Kanaski, PhD candidate in Earth and Environmental Science at the University of New Hampshire. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Catherine.
So to begin, can you introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about your connection to the Northeast and Maine?
Of course. So my name is Caroline Kanaski, and I am a scientist. I'm a community ecologist and forest entomologist. I'm currently a PhD candidate at the University of New Hampshire, and my advisor is Dr. Jeff Garnis, and our lab works on a lot of different forest health concerns like emerald ash borer and beech bark disease. And so more about me, like I am not a native New Englander. I actually grew up in Northeastern Pennsylvania, but I moved to New Hampshire in 2017 for my graduate work, starting with my master's. And I've been here ever since on the seacoast of New Hampshire. I spend a lot of my free time exploring like New Hampshire and Maine, especially after I discovered my love of hiking in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And my graduate research has also routinely brought me to lots of different forested areas throughout the Northeast. And for my work particularly, I've been to Acadia National Park and the pitch pine barrens of Waterboro, Maine, and Ossipee, New Hampshire, Cape Cod off of Massachusetts, and also Long Island, New York. So I've been kind of all over the Northeast for my work.
No, I know you've been a little bit all over the Northeast because I got to spend some time in the field with you over the summer in Acadia, which was so cool. And that kind of brings me to your research project about the southern pine beetle. You have a really fun and interesting and surprising story about how you came up with the idea for your research project in Acadia. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about that discovery story?
About finding southern pine beetle in Maine?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So first off, I want to say this beetle, southern pine beetle, this is a native bark beetle to North America. And so I said bark beetle, and that's just a very small type of beetle that lives under bark. You might have heard about the mountain pine beetle that's been causing tree damage in the American West. This is very similar. And you might have heard about mountain pine beetle in the news. So southern pine beetle is native to the southeastern U.S., as the name kind of suggests, but you could also find it in parts of Mexico and Central America. Historically, the northernmost part of this beetle's range was southern Pennsylvania and New Jersey, but it was kind of rare to find them there. Only once in a while would you see these beetles in those places. More recently, climate change is impacting the beetle's range. And so this makes sense because this insect, it really cares about the coldest night of the year. We have a few different estimates for the We have a few different estimates for the lower lethal temperature of this beetle, or just, you know, the cold temperature that kills it. We know that it's somewhere between 3 and negative 10 Fahrenheit. So the warmer that our coldest night of the year is, the more likely that the southern pine beetle can survive in any particular place. These are very tiny beetles, about 2 to 3 millimeters long. So about the size of half a grain of rice. They're about the size and color of a mouse poop. I think that's more descriptive. And you might be surprised to know that something so tiny can kill trees. So the background, we're really leading up to finding southern pine beetle in Maine, right? These insects are really tiny, but they work together to kill trees. And so how do they work together? They orchestrate this using chemical communication. And that chemical they use is called a pheromone. And in the southern pine beetle's native range, we know that the southern pine beetle's predators can like eavesdrop on this communication in order to find their prey, the beetle. And it's almost as if that these different insects are speaking different languages. So I wanted to know if any insects in the northeastern forests could eavesdrop on this southern pine beetle pheromone, even though they've never been exposed to the chemical before. Almost as if, could you understand a language you never heard before? It's a strange analogy. Some entomologists might not like it, but I think it works for just generally thinking about this chemical communication. So what I did was I designed an insect trapping study, and I traveled to Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts. I wanted to go further, but this was during COVID and I couldn't travel more than about 2 hours from my school. And so what I did was I used the southern pine beetle's pheromone to figure out which insects in our forests could maybe respond to these chemicals. And I had these traps out in the forest for almost 2 years straight. I was regularly checking on everything I collected because I wanted to know if I found southern pine beetles, I would have to alert landowners and state entomologists. I don't want to be causing a problem, or I want to alert them of a problem. And so towards the very end of my experiment, you know, it's almost been 2 years, things are going just as planned. I checked on my traps in late October of 2021. And other backstory is I just ran my first marathon. My legs were super sore. And I wasn't that excited about hiking into the forest that morning, and it was cold. So my advisor said, you don't have to check the traps. We haven't really been getting anything. We can skip 1 week. It'll be okay. But I decided I still needed to go out because I didn't want to have just one gap in this 2 year long data collection. And that day, the first stop, I kind of do like a trapping loop, kind of driving around the different forests. My first stop was the Waterboro Barrens in Waterboro, Maine. And I remember this super well because it was the first morning of the fall when my hands were cold, you know, like when it starts to get kind of frosty, and I was not prepared with gloves. But as soon as I looked into this first trap, I was pretty sure I was looking at southern pine beetles. And so I texted a friend and colleague, Tom Schmielk of the Maine Forest Service, and he's an awesome entomologist. So I asked him, do you think it's possible to identify these tiny beetles without a microscope? And he said, probably yes, like you've seen enough of them. So when I got back to the lab that afternoon, I put these beetles under a microscope and I confirmed I was looking at southern pine beetles. And so this finding launched like a whole flurry of emails. My advisor and I were on TV. We were on Maine Public Radio. We had a spot on News Center Maine, and I never thought any of this would happen. Maybe we would find southern pine beetle in Maine in my lifetime, but not during my PhD.
Let's dig more into what exactly finding the southern pine beetle means.
So these insects, they're working together to attack a healthy tree. That's important. We have a lot of insects that are native, and you can find them in our forests right now, that are breaking down dead and dying trees. And that's super important. I want to make that very clear. Like, we need insects in our forests to help break down wood. Wood is amazing. You can cut this part out, but wood is really amazing and structurally sound, right? We build so many things with it. It's hard to break down, and these insects are doing it. They're doing the hard work. Anyways, these insects are boring into healthy trees, and the tree is responding. It's defending itself. And so it's using resin or pitch or sap to try to get rid of these beetles. And so if you've ever cut down an evergreen tree, or you maybe cut your own Christmas tree, you know that like pine resin is super sticky. It's hard to get off your hands. It's hard to get out of your clothes. But this beetle is swimming through it. And I think that's amazing. And if the beetles can successfully swim through the tree's resin, they can begin to chew in the phloem layer. And this is a thin, spongy, sugary layer between the bark and the wood of the tree. And that's where these beetles spend most of their time. The beetles are going to chew through there, creating this thing we call a gallery, or it's kind of like a little maze. And they're laying their eggs. And if all goes well, the cycle is going to continue from here. I want to make a very important note that when the population is big enough, that's when we really have this threat of southern pine beetle spreading and having an outbreak in our forests. I found just a couple beetles in York County in 2021, and we haven't found more beetles since then. And that's good for us, that we have time to make decisions. We have time to take action to help prevent southern pine beetle from spreading. And it would take hundreds or thousands of beetles in one trap to give us the signal that this population is building.
Thank you so much, Caroline. We just listened to Caroline Kanaski on her research on the southern pine beetle. Earlier in the episode, we listened to Jay Wason on his research about extreme climate and its impacts on trees. I'm your host, Catherine Devine of Scudic Institute. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Coastal Conversations.
Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of Coastal Conversations. Join us on the fourth Friday of each month at 4 p.m. for information, stories, and conversations about the issues and people of the Maine coast. That great music you're hearing in the background is called A Following Sea and was composed and performed by Paul Anderson. On behalf of Maine Sea Grant and in partnership with Scudic Institute and the First Coast, we wish you a good weekend.